This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Ballow. Each week on the show, we zero in on a topic in the news, and we offer up some historical context. This week, it's all about alcohol and its consequences. Drunkenness. Wastedness. Call it what you will.
Gone.
Smashed.
Blitzed.
Blasted.
Soused.
Sloshed.
Plastered.
Buzzed.
Schnockered is one.
Fustigated.
Spifflicated.
Three sheets to the wind.
Three sheets to the wind.
Three sheets to the wind.
Absolutely soused.
Ah, alcohol. How it inspires language. How it inspires long lists of ways to refer to its own neurological effects. We all have our own favorite terms for inebriation, but it's probably safe to say that nobody has as many of them as Benjamin Franklin.
Addled, afflicted, as good conditioned as a puppy, bewitched, been at Barbados, Cherry Mary. Has scalded his head.
In 1736, Franklin published the Drinker's Dictionary, a kind of single subject thesaurus with more than 200 variations on the theme.
He's fishy, fuddled, sore-footed. He's eat the coconut. Got a brass eye. Got on his little hat. In the suds. Loose in the hilts. Like a rat in trouble. Owes no man a farthing. He sees two moons. Tanned. Tongue-tied. Been too free with Sir John Strawberry. He makes Virginia fence. He's very weary.
Now that's an impressive list, but it's certainly not complete. Tell us what you'd add to a drinker's dictionary. Visit BackstoryRadio.org and click Join the Discussion.
Hey, another call all the way from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we've got Patty on the line. Patty!
Yes, sir.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're talking about alcohol.
Well, it's a favorite topic of the Irish, and
that
I am of Irish extraction.
It sounds Irish, doesn't it? Patty.
With two Ds.
Yeah.
I am fourth generation Irish in America.
Uh-huh.
But I married a man of Irish extraction, and I was interested to see, since he's from the East Coast, the persistence of alcohol in Irish-American culture.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it's famous in Irish culture.
Right.
But it's part of Irish-American culture as well.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much that had to do with the rejection of immigrants in the 19th century when the, you know, the teetotal programs were just getting started, and then in come all these immigrants
right.
who have drink as part of their culture, not just
yeah.
an occupation. Indeed, it was deeply woven into the literature, the music, the jokes.
Yeah, so, Patty, you're suggesting in a way that Irish people in America have used alcohol as a form of cultural expression, sort of snubbing their noses at those waspy Yankees, those disapproving teetotaler types.
Yeah, they were pretty unashamedly drinkers.
But there's also the phenomenon of the lace curtain Irish, as they're called.
Right.
That is the very hyper-respectable Irish, out-Yankee the Yankee in terms
right.
of their sobriety and so
That's
forth.
My husband's family.
Yeah. Boring!
But alcoholism does run along with the charm and the talk.
You have conflicted feelings about it, is what you're saying right now. That is, it's been a problem for Irish people.
It's known as the Irish curse. And in my family, in my husband's family, in my in-laws' families, every family has at least one alcoholic. Everybody's aware of it. My parents, actually, they were not alcoholic, and they never had a drinking problem. But there had been alcoholics in both sides of their families.
Right.
So they raised us with the AA Blue Book. I mean, they brought it in the house when I was 10, and
no
they explained
kidding.
To us, et cetera. But it's still part of the culture.
But, you know, Patty, I want to comment on something that is reflected in your call itself, which is because your name is Patty and because you're an Irish American, you can talk very openly about certain things that in the mouths of others would be seen as stereotypes.
And true.
I think there's a bit of an answer to your question in this observation, which is whether or not the Irish drink more or not, the Irish themselves are able to talk about this openly in ways that certainly would give the impression that Irish drink more, whether you happen to be right or not.
That's true.
Yeah, it's part of the folklore, you might say, and certainly stereotypes. And when Irish people talk about them, of course, they're not malign stereotypes. We've come a long way from those caricatures of the 19th century.
thankfully, too.
Yes, indeed. And it's been great talking to you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you,
Thanks
Patty.
For calling. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's take another call. We've got Joy on the line from Albany, New York. Joy, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
I'd like to talk a little bit about the dichotomy between how we expect our teens to behave in terms of their alcohol consumption and what we allow for ourselves, and whether or not it's really fair to expect more of our teens than the behavior we actually model for them.
Whoa, that's a heavy question. So we're
May I ask how old you are, Joy?
I'm 24.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we've got a minimum age here.
Yeah, you're practically a teenager as far as we're concerned. So you're talking about double standards.
Yes, I think that we expect our teens to be moderate alcohol consumers and not drink and drive.
Yeah.
And we as adults don't necessarily model that behavior. And when an adult does get caught drinking and driving, there's no guarantee that there will be an actual punishment.
And it's what's interesting is how it's tied in right now. I'm a university president, too. We've been wrestling with this. Should the drinking age be reduced to 18 so that it can be better, frankly, managed by those of us who have responsibility for large numbers of these young people?
Guys, let's do some history here. This is the backstory, right? I mean, okay. I know that's threatening, but what about drinking ages through history? And the whole notion of Joy's question is about how we manage. When do adults begin worrying about teenagers acting out and link it to alcohol consumption?
Like, my understanding is that youth alcohol use really wasn't an issue until the 20th century and really actually the post-World War II period.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it just, first of all, in terms of the 19th century, children and teens were seen as the victims of parental alcohol abuse, particularly paternal alcohol abuse.
Yeah, good point, good point.
And why it's a 20th century issue, number one, I think, is the car and the combination of drinking and driving and the inherent necessity of state regulation, certainly of cars. And the state had regulated alcohol for a long time, but not necessarily in regard to kids. Mm-hmm. Secondly, income. You know, money in your pocket. And it's after World War II and especially the 1960s that large corporations start targeting kids for major marketing campaigns. And they do that because for the first time, kids, middle class kids, begin to have a lot of spare change. They can get their hands on this alcohol pretty easily.
Right.
And in some ways, the concept of the problem of teenage drinking begins when we have teenagers, which is also a 20th century invention. You know, before that, just a gradation between children and adults. And but when they became a distinct category, sharply defined, then it looked like a problem to be solved.
Yeah. You know, it all gets tied up in questions of consent. That is, when can teenagers be considered responsible adults and take responsibility for their behavior? And I think there's a tremendous discrepancy now between arriving at an age in which you're capable of driving cars and going to parties and drinking a lot and being responsible, because we've protracted adolescence well into the 20s, if not the 30s, for our kids.
You know, maybe age is not the right way to do this. There's certainly lots of ways to predict who is going to be a responsible drinker. And we now have lots
DNA
of ways
testing
to accumulate.
Or what?
No, not DNA testing. The insurance companies know all of this. They know about differences between men and women. They know about differences between people based on their grade point average. Those might end
sounds
up being
like profiling.
Those
to
might
me,
end
Brian.
Up being much better predictors than age. But Peter, I think you really put your finger on it. Age seems neutral. We're not picking on, you know, male athletes with GPAs below 2.0, for instance. On the other hand, to address Joy's very real issue, you know, to discriminate against the responsible 20-year-old may not make sense in this day and age.
Okay, Joy. Well, we wish you joy.
It's been a pleasure talking to
you. Great. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, guys, we've come full circle. We started the show with the drinking age, and here we are again. But as a 20th century guy, I have to point out that there's still an important chapter in the history of alcohol use that we have not mentioned, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. AA was started in 1935 by Bill Wilson, a recovering alcoholic. Wilson embraced what at the time was a new idea. That idea was that alcoholism wasn't a moral failing, it was a disease. But Wilson also believed that healing involved a spiritual undertaking and came up with the famous 12 steps to recovery. Recently, I had the chance to sit down with a therapist at one of the country's preeminent 12-step programs, the Hazelden Center in Minnesota. His name is Fred Holmquist, and I asked him what he thought about the temperance and prohibition efforts of the past.
The idea of temperance doesn't work for alcoholics or addicts because if it was just a matter of signing an oath and saying no and getting off of this stuff, you know, detoxes would crank out winners.
Right.
And detoxes don't crank out winners because when people put mood-altering substances in their systems, one of the symptoms of addiction is they're not able to predict when they're going to stop once they start. And then the other as critical symptom is that once they stop, they're not able to stay stopped, even though they couldn't have made a more sincere commitment. So, you know, quitting's easy. I've done it thousands of times.
Yeah. Now, we don't blink an eyelid at the term illness for alcoholism today, but historically, that's something that's changed quite a bit, hasn't it? The perception that this is an illness?
It has changed quite a bit, but the idea of addiction being an illness certainly wasn't started in the 20th century. Many people throughout history going way back have considered and seen addictive processes as disease processes. Now, the program of action, there's the community of the people who share in a common peril and also who share in a common solution. The solution, the common solution, is defined by the 12 steps. And AA's 12 steps, and I quote, are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole.
Fred, you've mentioned the word spiritual, and in my historical understanding of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step program, spirituality is a very important part of it. It was at the beginning. Is that still the case? And can you explain a little bit what you mean by the spiritual component or spirituality?
I think the presence of the word, you know, spiritual in terms of the 12 steps has a lot to do with the wisdom of the 12 steps that essentially helps people understand that one of the reasons this illness is so devastating is that it engages them at all three levels of human existence, physically, mentally, and spiritually. The physical component is referred to as the physical allergy. The mental component is referred to as the mental obsession, and the spiritual component has basically to do with a basic theological premise that there's something beyond humanness and thought in each human being. And the text Alcoholics Anonymous's version of that says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And I would say that's represented in other wisdom faith traditions as soul.
Something outside of oneself.
Actually, no. Actually, something absolutely already inside oneself.
I got it.
In essence, the text Alcoholics Anonymous lets people know that there is a deeper element of goodness and truth inside them already, always has been, always will be, and that in terms of the spiritual solution for addiction, that's the only place they're going to find it.
Fred Holmquist is director of the Lodge Program at Hazelden Treatment Center in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, guys, since all three of us are a bit addicted to history, I want to turn to you for the great historical irony here, right? I mean, it's not until after World War II that we begin treating alcoholism as a disease. And it's also after World War II that this great medical establishment grows. We do all kinds of heroic surgery, and now we live in an era of all these wonder drugs. But I think Fred's right in that the most effective treatment of addiction, and specifically alcoholism, turns on spirituality. So what does that say about the different kinds of directions we're moving in the second half of the 20th century?
Yeah, I think we're really getting at the notion that the alcoholic is always an alcoholic. There's no cured alcoholic. And therefore, it's not disease in the conventional sense of something you get over. It's something that's always with you. And the irony, it seems to me, is that you have to totally embrace the identity of an alcoholic in order to deal with alcoholism.
You know what that sounds like to me?
What?
Original sin, Puritans.
You got it. Yeah, and that's a nice point, Ed.
But do we today blame people? I mean, sin entails a certain degree of—
Original sin?
Well, yeah, I think we do, absolutely. You blame somebody who will not take the 12 steps. In other words, who will not embrace this new identity or this total alcoholic identity in order to transcend it. I think that's precisely, as Ed is saying, the notion of original sin and conversion.
Yeah, you've got to renounce your sin. I mean, it's not your fault that you are a sinner, because we all are. It's not your fault you're an alcoholic.
And Ed, when you renounce sin, it doesn't mean you stop being a sinner. There's no idea of perfection here.
Yeah,
we are radically imperfect. Call it what you will. That sounds like original sin to me.
So, Peter, are you saying that we're really no farther along than where we started in terms of alcoholism being a sin? I know the name changes.
Well, I think the temperance movement originally preaches the spirit of moderation and does suggest that you can drink a little bit and that you've got to live a healthy lifestyle. In many ways, most of us are modern temperance people who believe that we have it in our control to regulate our alcohol intake. But there's always been a strong pull from evangelical Christianity toward the stark recognition that we have no control over our appetites, that is, that we are prone to addiction. And it seems to me that in one way or another, whenever we have recognized our proneness to addiction, we are reframing the idea of original sin, and that's right at the heart of the 12-step program.
Yeah, there's no question that, you know, the Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of these movements have made remarkable differences for individuals, and it's been a blessing in that way. I guess what we're talking about is the way these big currents of impulses sweep through American history, and it's not really about individual motivation or improvement, but rather about a desire for sort of purging the culture of these addictive possibilities.
Right.
So that's what I believe, Brian. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that certainly helps me. And it's a lucky thing, too, because that's all the time we have for today. Remember, we always want to keep the conversation going online. Visit us at backstoryradio.org and leave a comment with your thoughts on today's program.
We'll be back next week for more Rooting Around in the American Past.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore.
Jamal Milner mixed the show. Gabby Alter composed our theme. Lydia Wilson provides administrative support. And Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Wendell.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, and Kerry Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.